Hi, hello, and welcome. The name of the podcast is Lexington Stories, Lore, and More. I'm Alan Lytle, and of course, my co-host is Fiona Young-Brown. She is the author of Secret Lexington, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. Good day to you.
Hello again, and good day.
And good day.
It's very formal.
It's a good, good day, because we're into March now, and you know what March is? March is Women's History Month. Yes.
Not basketball?
No, well,
I had to throw that out there.
Well, we don't know how the outcome is going to be when it comes to the our respective teams in March Madness this year. But one thing we can always count on is that in March, we celebrate the accomplishments and just the very nature of women throughout Lexington and everywhere else.
And there are a lot of very accomplished women in Lexington's history.
As we are about to find out, because I hit a premise with Fiona, and we'll see how much homework she has done from her last assignment. And that would be, if Lexington had a Mount Rushmore of women, who would be on it and why? And we start with that premise. You know, there's a lot of famous women that have come through Lexington, have been born and raised in Lexington, or did a lot of amazing things here in Lexington. You know, if we're talking about maybe only four that could go up on the Mount Rushmore of Lexington, who would it be? First of all, where would you locate the Mount Rushmore in Lexington? We're kind of flat.
That would be a good question. Wait, yeah, we're kind of lacking in the hills. And, you know, obviously I...
Maybe if you could annex the Pinnacles.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
So as you're riding along,
possibly,
you know, canoeing along the Kentucky River, you look up and there they are, all
yeah.
Lexington's women.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's just
it's okay, folks. We're not proposing that before you argue that we're about to destroy the Pinnacles. I promise we're not.
Just thinking out loud here. Just thinking out loud. Otherwise, you'd have to construct your own mountain and then carve it. So, you know, we're just trying to save some time.
Front yard sculpture, anyone?
Okay, so, Fiona, who would be your first person that you would...
See, this was a really tricky question, because finding just four
was
a really tricky one. There are way too many. That's why we need all of the Pinnacles and not just four. Let me think. If I had to choose... Let's see, who will I choose for my first one? I am going to go with Dr. Mary Ellen Britton.
A good choice, because didn't they just name a new elementary school for Mary Ellen Britton?
They did. I noticed that the other day. I think it's the one opposite Costco.
It's out there in Hamburg.
And so it's good to see that she's getting some recognition.
Okay, so what would make her head and shoulders, pardon the pun, above the rest?
She was the first female doctor licensed in Lexington. She was also the first African-American female doctor in Lexington. She didn't just practice medicine. She set up the Negro Education Association in Kentucky. She was the president of the Women's Improvement Club. She set up schools for orphans. She was a teacher. She did a lot of work in and around Lexington for colored children, poor women, and so on. She attended Berea College. She was just well ahead of her time and an excellent member of the community.
And she had quite a long run of accomplishments here in Lexington.
She did. She was actually, I should go ahead and say, she was relatively lucky as a person of color in the time frame when she was born in 1855, but she was actually born as a free person of color, which already gives her obviously some advantages. And she was also born into a family that truly valued education, which again placed her in a much more fortunate position than a lot. She and her 9 siblings all received a very good education. She was able to attend private school. There were certain scholarships set up at the time. She went to Berea College, which at the time was, I think, the only one in Kentucky that accepted African-American students.
We know it was started by John G. Fee. That much we mm-hmm. do, that much I know, yes.
Yeah. And then after that, she returned to Lexington and worked as a teacher in the public schools, which again was segregated at the time. And she worked in the schools for about 20 years and then just decided to leave education behind and go in a completely new direction. So any women listening to this who are considering a career change,
you can do it.
You can do it. She actually went up to the Battle Creek Sanitarium in Michigan, which I always think of as Kellogg's. And
I do too. Especially all of that movie.
Yes.
I think John Cusack was in it, maybe, and Anthony.
Was Anthony Hopkins?
Anthony Hopkins, yes. Yep. Yes. He played the patriarch,
and
Kellogg.
So yeah. She went and started working up there for a while and to learn about hypnotherapy, electrotherapy, hydrotherapy, all of these sort of different therapeutic techniques. And then she came back to Lexington and started practicing them. I'm guessing that being the only woman in town but who could practice these was probably a selling point for a lot of the women in town. She started practicing them out of her home. In 1902, she was granted a license to practice medicine, the first woman in Lexington. And she had a practice on North Limestone for, I think, more than 20 years or so until her death. Offering all of these various therapies and treatments.
And there were attempts to honor her. I don't know exactly how many, but we do know that, as we had mentioned at the top of the show, Mary E. Britton Elementary bears her name mm-hmm. now.
It does, and it's good to see. One of my kind of peeves as I drive around town is it was only last year that we got a statue dedicated to a specific Lexington woman. We only had the first statue of women a few years ago. And the first one of a specific woman was the Harriet Hayden statue went up late last year. And so, you know, a school dedicated to Dr. Britton, I will take that. It's hope if it means that kids and people around town are like, who was she? I need to look into her story.
We could maybe get in a quick plug here. I think it's coming up this Sunday. You might be aware of the Lexington History Museum and the League of Women Voters had co-sponsored this contest and this effort to honor women. It was called Stand With Her Story. Mm-hmm. And I think on Sunday afternoon, they are going to read all of the names of the people that folks you kind of wrote in and wrote a little essay about. And so all of those women are going to be honored at that monument, which is called The Stand.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interested in that, love to see you there.
Sunday afternoon.
This coming Sunday afternoon. So that's one.
So, yep.
How about number two?
Oh, I've got to go for the whole four, I think. Oh, let's see.
Or is there more on Mary Ellen Britton?
I think that's all I have on her for now, but I think that's pretty impressive. She's got an impressive list of accomplishments.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's see. Who else would I put? I am going to go with, and this is a wonderful name, Sophonisba Breckinridge. I hope I've said that right.
Sophonisba Breckinridge. Yes. This was around the suffragette era.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And actually, there are a number of women who could easily go on our female Mount Rushmore based on suffragism, equal rights, and so on around this era. But what makes her stand out for me, and I will admit she did not spend a lot of her life in Lexington. She was born here, but then spent most of her life doing work in Chicago. But she was the first woman to pass the Kentucky Bar Exam in 1895. So we've got the first female doctor and the first female attorney. She then went to Chicago and became the first woman to get a PhD in political science and in economics. And from what I could see, I couldn't be entirely sure. The way it was written was very vague. I couldn't tell if she'd got one PhD or if she'd got several a couple of years apart.
I would think that she is just the consummate overachiever. So let's just say that she did.
She also was the first woman to get her law degree, her JD, at the University of Chicago. So she just went for every single first that she could find. And that's not enough, because in 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt sent her to represent the U.S., at the Pan American Conference in Uruguay, making her the first woman to represent the United States in an international conference setting.
How about that?
So, I mean, she just racked them all up. She was born here in Lexington. She was educated here in Lexington, and then moved to Chicago and spent the rest of her life there studying, writing, developing social work, developing academic programs, dealing with poverty, child labor, which was a huge issue at the time, women's poverty, and so on.
How did Lexingtonians regard her as she is going out there and making these incredible accomplishments?
You know, I haven't looked into that a great deal, but I can imagine it must. I mean, I'm thinking if it were me looking at someone, it would be kind of a mixed bag, because on the one hand, she is achieving incredible, wonderful things. You know, all of these firsts and all of this work for the greater community, poverty and so on that we mentioned. But at the same time, I'm certain there were probably a number of critics or detractors whose argument was, well, why did she go to Chicago to do that and not try to do it here? You know, and she was involved with Hull House in Chicago, which was a huge major program in the city at the time. So I think there was probably a little bit of a mixed reaction, would be my guess.
And what about Madeline McDowell Breckinridge?
She was another one. See, you read my mind.
Now, the two of them would be on Mount Rushmore, or you went with something used to the first?
I don't know. Madeline McDowell would also be a good one. And to be fair, a couple of historians did say she was the most influential woman in the state. So, I mean, and that kind of means she has to be on there anyway. And she achieved an incredible amount in a relatively short life. She had a lot of health issues and so on throughout her life as well. So the fact that she did achieve so much is, you know, at a time when it would have been very easy and understandable as a woman, and as a woman with health issues, it almost would have been expected that she, you know, take to her bed and lead a life of seclusion or something.
But both from the same family.
Yes, just through marriage, and I get very confused with all of the marriages between the prominent families and distant cousins and so on. She was part of the Clay family. We have to mention that. She was Henry Clay's great-granddaughter. And actually, if I remember correctly, grew up on the grounds of Ashland. I'm friends with the curator of Ashland, and if he's listening to this and I get it wrong, I will get a message from Eric later.
How you doing,
today.
Eric?
But again, she was very well educated. She married Desha Breckinridge. This is where the Breckinridge, the other prominent family, come in. He was the editor of the Lexington Herald at the time.
Was he Desha?
I'm never sure how to pronounce it.
Desha.
Yeah. Desha sounds more likely.
Well, there was
a restaurant
downtown in Lexington called Desha. So let's just call him Desha.
And he was editor of the Lexington Herald. He was, by all accounts, very progressive for the time, and so I'm sure was in some ways, because we'll get to this, very supportive of her work and so on. Sadly, he was also apparently a little bit of a Lothario, shall we say. So wasn't
womanizer.
The most faithful husband.
A cad.
Yes, a cad. But his progressive politics, he was very supportive of the work that she was doing. She went to State College, which is now the University of Kentucky. And she started out as very athletic. She was very much into sports. And then she developed tuberculosis, which led to a number of other infections. And so she had to have part of her leg amputated. And so that put an end to her athletic interests, but really kind of reinforced her commitment to health reform, education reform, and to her studies. Education reform was the big one for her. Women's rights to education, voting reform, and just education needing to be more than just how to find a good husband and how to look pretty in a room while you played the piano and so on. She also wanted to make sure that education was available to poor people in the city, that it wasn't, you know, unavailable because of race and so on. She did a lot of work in education reform, a lot of work in health reform. She set up the Lincoln School Project here in town, which, despite the name, sounds as if it was so much more than a school. It provided education for poor kids, but it also apparently provided adult classes for working adults, for immigrants. It provided trade skills. It had also some health services. So it had a whole child care.
And where was this Lincoln parents. School? Where was it located?
I tried to find that, and I haven't done enough research yet. I couldn't.
Here in Lexington?
It was here in Lexington, yes.
Okay, all right.
So I'm not sure where in town it was. It sounds as though it was one sizable campus for everything that was on it. She also set up and helped to support a number of free clinics around the town, because as well as suffering from tuberculosis, when she was just 32, she had a major stroke. And so that again, she recovered, but that again left her in weakened health. And so she was very, very vehement about the fact that everyone should have access to vaccinations, especially the tuberculosis. She set up clinics so that people could get vaccinated. And again, the education with the focus on so that people could learn about their health and how to take care of themselves. So she did a lot in a relatively short life, because she had another stroke when she was, let me do the math quickly here, I think 48. Yep. When she was just 48, she had another stroke, and this time it was fatal. So,
wow.
So she had a lot of health issues throughout her life, but really actually used those to galvanize her own work for the betterment of the community.
That is a strong argument for an appearance on Mount Rushmore. And correct me if I'm wrong, but we have like her to thank for Woodland Park too, correct?
I believe we do. Again, if we're wrong about that, Eric will call in.
Us. Yes. But it's very interesting because they're both from the same era. Of course, Mary Britton mm-hmm. was late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yep.
And so that's three of the four right there.
I know. This was in some ways it was a horrible era because there was, there was so much illness and poverty and so on. But this was an era when you really had women stepping up and saying, right, no, we're not going to take this anymore. So some incredible women.
By and large, less agency, if you will, than the women of today do. But there had to be trailblazers, and these are the trailblazers we're talking about.
And I believe, I haven't been to the state capitol in Frankfurt for a while, but I believe there is still a portrait of Madeline McDowell Breckinridge hanging, I think, in the rotunda or somewhere in the capitol.
That would not surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
We have to throw out our contacts and see if that is truly the case. And, you know, again, a podcast is a wonderful thing because you can listen to it and you can let us know if we made any glaring errors or some oversights.
If there are some updates.
Yes, some updates. Yes. And so, okay, who would be your fourth?
See, now this is the tricky one because who would be
the one that you would throw out immediately would probably be Mary Todd Lincoln, but
yeah,
that's problematic.
I had a really hard time because part of me thinks she would be the obvious choice. I mean, she was the first lady of America, which I think is, you know, was a major achievement for Lexington. She also was, in a lot of ways, she helped to really shape the role of first lady. She was much more involved that and much more visible to the public than some of the previous first ladies had been. She was very well educated. She's a fascinating woman. I mean, I've read several biographies of her and really enjoy reading about her. She was smart. She was devoted to Abe Lincoln and supporting his career and so on. And then obviously had a really tragic, tragic life, not just in terms of her husband, but also the loss of her children and so on. And so on the one hand, she seems to be an obvious choice. And at the same time, dare I say it, but compared to the other women that we've just been talking about who had these incredible achievements in their own right, I'm going to say that I don't know that she...
She would be the lady in waiting, perhaps?
Yeah, it feels as if her achievements were all tied to someone else, rather than she wasn't the one out there pushing for reform and setting up clinics and becoming the first this, that, and the other. And so from that perspective, sorry, Mary, but you're looking like a lesser contender.
So if this is like American Idol, we thank you for your appearance and, you know, see your way
out
the door.
Good job. We appreciate what you've done.
But you didn't make the cut.
I'm not sure that you make the cut. And but it's a really tricky
Gwen Thompson
decision.
Is out there probably apoplectic at this point because she's at the Mary Todd
Lincoln house. I love
Mary
Todd Lincoln. I love how I think she's fascinating. I think she gets a really bad rap in a lot of media that really doesn't take into account everything she suffered through. But I'm just not sure that she can be on our...
You're not there.
Rushmore.
You're just not there. Okay.
I need a bit more convincing, Mary.
Well, maybe we better get, we could maybe reach out to Gwen and she could probably give us her best argument for why.
There we go. Am I making enemies that I'm now going to walk around town and all these curators are going to be running out after me?
I'm reminded of the movie The Graduate when Norman Fell, believe it or not, he was an RA or whatever, and he looks at Dustin Hoffman and says, "You're one of them agitators. That's what you're one of them agitators. We want him out of here. You got 5 minutes to get out of here." So I'm one of them agitators. That's my role today, is to agitate and to advocate, if you will. So, all right. So we know it's not Mary Todd Lincoln. Who would it be then?
And this is the problem. I really can't decide on that fourth one. I mean, there's going back to Ashland, obviously, there is Laura Clay.
Yes, we haven't even gotten to her.
Who was an incredible woman again in this fantastic era. And actually, I say Ashland, but despite the name, she was actually the youngest daughter of Cassius Clay and so grew up out in Whitehall. So can I make the argument there that she was technically from... I mean, she did grow up and was from Richmond.
There is a difference if you're Richmond versus Lexington.
I mean, she did move to Lexington, but I don't know. I mean, there could be the argument either way, but she's definitely deserving. Who else do we have? I mean,
well, let's just say, for the sake of argument, she is hereby disqualified because, I mean, if we had a controversial
decision, but the judge's rule must be final.
Absolutely. We got a big board here, and we're taking that name off and sliding in somebody else.
Oh, but who are we going to slide in? I mean, Harriet Hayden I mentioned earlier, and she does now have a statue dedicated to her and her husband here in Lexington.
And why should we know more about Harriet Hayden?
She was an abolitionist and an important part of the Underground Railroad. Her husband's story is actually very sad and was kind of the impetus for...
We're talking about Lewis Hayden.
Lewis right? Hayden, mm-hmm. yes.
Yeah.
He was enslaved, and his wife and son, his first wife and infant son, were both sold to Henry Clay, who at the time was a slaveholder. He then sold them down the river, as it were, to the Deep South. And a couple of things about that. First of all, the Deep South at the time, if you were sent down the river, that was not a good ending for anyone. You know, New Orleans and the Carolinas and so on were known to be particularly brutal. But also that meant he never saw his wife and son again. When he married Harriet, his second wife, Harriet Hayden, he vowed that he was never going to risk that happening again. He was not going to lose his family a second time. And so they set about planning their escape. There were several abolitionists in town, several white abolitionists who could help and facilitate. They were able to escape and then make their way all the way to Boston.
Via the Underground Railroad.
Through the Underground Railroad, yes. That was in 1844 that they escaped. Once they were in Boston, they decided that obviously it was their role now to speak out, to work towards abolition, and to help others escape. And so their house in Boston kind of became, it was a stop on the Underground Railroad in its own right. It also became a center of kind of local community abolitionist movements. And you can actually, the house, I believe, now is open to the public in Boston and is a museum. So obviously, deservedly, they got a statue last year, which is down on the corner of Limestone and 4th. If you haven't seen it yet, it's well worth driving past to give it a look. She would obviously be deserving of a spot. There's so many people that deserve a spot.
Harriet, what were some of her standout accomplishments along with Lewis?
I mean, the main thing was that they both, not just that they escaped, but that once they did escape, they were both adamant that they needed to do more. So it wasn't just a case of she sat at home while Lewis went out and gave speeches and wrote and so on. They were both, she was equally active in speaking out against slavery, speaking out about her experiences, and really facilitating more the movement of more enslaved people through the Underground Railroad to freedom.
Well, we also then maybe have to consider Charlotte Dupuy, correct?
Yes. See, and that's why we need more than four.
We just need a big mountain to put all of these women up here.
And I'll be honest, I hadn't heard of Charlotte Dupuy until the last week, and I still don't know a whole lot about her. But in the 1820s, I believe it was, she was an enslaved woman and sued Henry Clay for her freedom, which I think is just impressive on a whole number of different factors. That she was suing for her freedom, that she was suing for her freedom at this early stage, that she was suing Henry Clay, who sort of, you know, this renowned attorney, the great compromiser, and so on. I mean, there are just so many different levels that she decided, no, I've had enough. This is what I'm going to do, which is...
Yeah, I mean, that daring...
Amazing.
Alone should, you know, get you consideration
The risks, I can't even begin to imagine the risks of even daring to say out loud, I want my freedom, and here's what I'm going to do about it, is impressive, seems an understatement.
Yeah. Okay. So I have teased you. So who would your fourth one be based on?
You're really pushing me to make a decision.
Well, or we could just throw this up and say, okay, here are some other names. And then you, our listeners, our dedicated listeners, you determine that fourth person.
Oh, that's good. Okay. I'm going to do that so that I don't have to make the decision.
And I'm not putting you
on
the spot.
Because I will always avoid making the decision if I have to. Okay. So let's see. We could have Laura Clay, but the judges have decided that she's technically from Richmond, so.
And Richmond ain't Lexington.
There you go. You have it.
There you go.
Charlotte Dupuy, who obviously, I think, you know, you could. She then lay the groundwork, I think, for Harriet Hayden. I think Harriet Hayden's work then definitely lay the groundwork for women like Dr. Mary Britton, and then right through, you know, the 60s and the 80s, the civil rights movements, Julietta Lewis, Audrey Grievous, and so on. So, I mean, you could definitely argue that Charlotte Dupuy was kind of she laid the groundwork for women of color in Lexington. Another notable woman, and this is just while we are discussing notable Lexington women of color, Susan Tabb was the first full-time African-American police officer, African-American female police officer in Lexington PD. And Lexington Police Department had a really, I was actually surprised that they had some officers of color and some women early.
Yes, this is a
in the 20th century. Because
we started talking about this before we started recording, and I want you to repeat this.
You tend to think of integration both in terms of gender and race. When it comes to the police force, again, I'm being honest here, you tend to think of that as relatively late in the day. Lexington had a male and female police officer in quotes in the 1914, 1915. And I say in quotes because they were only allowed to patrol and they were only assigned to patrol Douglas Park.
These are African Americans we're
yes,
talking about.
The African American yes. officers, a male and a female. And so they were only allowed to patrol Douglas Park because, of course, this was a time of heavy segregation. And so they had no other duties or roles within the police force. And so they were, I mean,
they had the power to arrest.
They had the power, but only within that boundary.
Right.
So that in itself, I mean, you know, obviously they were very limited in what they could do. In 1917, well, around 1915, 1914, about the same time, this was when we were having the huge vice crackdown in town. And so the reputable ladies of the city said, if we're going to be arresting so many of these women, we need a police matron. Was the official term they gave it. And the city and the police chief said, fine, give us a name. They didn't go, there's no hiring process in these days. It was get together and give us a name of who you recommend and we'll, okay. If you've approved them, we'll say yes.
And basically someone to patrol us, to monitor our
sort of, and to deal with the ladies when they are brought in for booking and so on, to deal with certain situations out on the streets.
We're talking about brothels here.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Just want to set that straight.
And resorts, as they were called at the time.
Places for gentlemen to...
A sporting parlor.
Sporting parlor. Okay. Yeah.
And so they nominated, well... Okay, she was always referred to in the papers as Mrs. Clarence Egbert. Her name was Margaret, Maggie Egbert. So in 1917, she became the city's first full-time female police officer. I should say, before you get, you know, your ideas about what this police officer looked like, she was 53 at the time. She was a tiny little woman, but described by one journalist a few years ago who did a write-up about her as a 98-pound pistol of dynamite.
Wow.
So,
not somebody you'd want to tangle with.
Apparently not. Okay. And I, You know, I have to wonder. I think I'm curious to know more about how she was in action. I'm suspecting that she was not out there, you know, punching up on the mean streets. I think it was more just kind of a firm hand and, you know, actually talking to people, maybe. She actually served until 1946.
That's a long.
She had a long reign. And so she dealt with a lot of the women on McGowan Street in the Vice District. She also dealt with, you know, various lost children, people that she'd find roaming the streets and so on. So obviously she had a long tenure. And that 98-pound pistol. And it is funny when you see pictures of her because, yeah, I mean, she was an older woman. I say that in quotes again because she was actually the same age as me when she was appointed. But they looked older in those days. I'm going to say that.
It was an old 53.
It was an older time. It was a different time.
Yes.
But, I mean, she definitely was not what you imagine a police officer to be like. But so continuing the interesting integration and so on, she, I would argue, then lay the groundwork for the first full-time African-American policewoman in Lexington. And when do you think she joined the police force?
Okay, so this had to be post-1940s. So, say somewhere in the 50s or 60s.
1924, which blew my mind when I read this.
Really? Okay.
When she joined the police department in 1924, the first full-time African-American woman, the first full-time African-American, I should also point out, because at this point, the only two other black officers were the two that were only allowed to patrol
Douglas Park. Okay, I'm following you.
When she joined the police department, the only other employee of color there in the department, which I'm guessing means that those two had already been let go, was the janitor. So she was the only officer of color. And again, she was hired because the black community in Lexington had been saying for several years, we want representation, we want someone who looks like
who
us
look like
and
us,
who,
yeah.
who is, you know, who can deal with community issues and so on. So she joined in 1924. She worked until 1941, which is when she passed away. So she was quite young when she died. But again, I was astounded to see that that was 1924. And there was, after that, a fairly sizable gap before the next ones, I think, as we got into the civil rights movement and so on.
Okay, so Susan Tabb then. Where does she enter the picture?
She was that first African-American full-time female police officer.
Oh, okay.
1924, Susan Tabb.
Okay, 1924, Susan Tabb. And so that's a strong argument for consideration, I would say.
I know, but then Harriet Hayden, Charlotte Dupuis, Laura Clay with the Equal Rights Amendment. Well, no, she's disqualified. I keep forgetting. Nope. Go back to Richmond. And then, of course, on a completely different tangent, my other alternative suggestions, based on my current research.
Which, let's face it, you're doing research on Belle Breezing and that entire...
The other women of sporting reputation, as the Herald Leader would have put it in those days. And so I know that many people would be horrified by the idea of the Mount Rushmore of women having a madam, as it were.
And that would be Belle Breezing. Because
I think Belle Breezing, I mean, there were many others who were also very successful and fascinating characters, but obviously she's the one
people are still
that
talking
everyone
about
knows
today.
About.
Yeah. Okay.
I know on the one hand people would be horrified by that. I also would make the case that she and the women like her, A, became incredibly successful businesswomen at a time when doing anything other than following the norm of getting married and having children was very frowned upon. They became very successful. Some of them became the richest women in Lexington at the time of their deaths. were also known for their philanthropic efforts around town. And so I would make, I mean, you could easily make an argument that Belle deserves a spot up there. And I know that there will be some people gasping with horror. But I would also point out that I believe she's mentioned on the Visit Lex site, or one of several of the key sites for notable Lexington women.
Yeah, I just happened to have it pulled up here in the studio. And yes, she is mentioned quite a bit on this this site, as is Charlotte, as is Madeline McDell Breckenridge, Laura Clay, Sophonisba Breckenridge. So, and then
does
Mary
it say
Ellen
there,
Britton.
If we're pronouncing it right,
it does not have a pronunciation.
Okay, we'll just assume that we are.
Maybe we'll get letters. I mean, if there's another Sophonisba out there, we'd certainly want to hear from you. That's for sure. Julietta Lewis and Audrey Grievous, you had sort of mentioned them.
And they are both, you know, there's the Grievous Family Center here in town. And obviously Julietta Market was named for
when it was in Grayline.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite the honor. Harriet Drury Van Meter,
who set up the International Book Project, if I remember correctly.
Correct.
Yes.
Yes. And, you know, the list goes on and on and on. But we've really hit a number of very important stories behind these incredible women that take up our history. And we're talking
maybe
about
the
more
fourth woman. This
yes.
has just occurred to me. Maybe the fourth woman should be the every woman, the woman of Lexington, past, present, and future. I'm not sure how you'd sculpt that. But.
multiple facets, multiple faces.
There we go.
Your visage here. Perhaps.
I am not the sculptor. This is not my problem to come up with that.
Me neither. As a matter of fact, in art class, they told me I didn't even draw recognizable stick figures. So, you know, that's not a talent that was bestowed upon me at birth.
You were being abstract.
Yeah, I was probably Picasso before I even knew who Picasso was, you know. So, but, you know, this list is, of course, woefully incomplete. If there is somebody in your universe, dear listener, that you think that we should consider or maybe even do a little research on, well, by all means, we'd love to hear from you as you're listening to this podcast. Maybe you're hiking the Pinnacles or driving on your way into work or, you know, doing whatever it is that you like to do while listening to podcasts. We certainly want to thank you, though, for dialing us up and giving us a listen. We're fairly new into this venture of stories, lore, and more. And, you know, we're always open to some feedback and if you have notes, as they say in the business, if you have notes, well, you know, we'd certainly like to hear from you within reason, of course. Temper that.
You know. Nice notes only.
Nice notes only. Because we're doing this for funsies, you know, and maybe it's fun for you to critique a podcast. Well, you know, have at it. But to sort of wrap this up, Fiona, the important thing is that women should be celebrated throughout the calendar year. But March, of course, is the time that's designated for Women's History Month. And that's why we're talking about these wonderful women today.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that really stands out as you look back at so many of these women is that at various times in history, there were very limited opportunities for women based on race, class, the family that they were born into, and so on. And so I think what makes these women stand out is not just that they stepped out beyond that and said, I can do this even if it's not expected, but that they then all also devoted themselves to saying, and now let me pay it forward, as it were. Let me see how I can help others.
Right. It starts with, I'll show you, and then now that I've done this, you can do it too.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And we have lots of different stories about that throughout Lexington's now 251 years mm-hmm. of existence. I know we're going into, we're America 250, but Lexington was there first.
We were there first.
Isn't that something?
And of course, there are many, many women in Lexington now doing the same thing, going out there and achieving wonderful things and really helping to better the community.
Maybe we'll hear some of those names on Sunday when that the list of Stand With Her Story, all of those women are called out, if you will, announced and pronounced to the folks that will gather at the stand at that monument to all women in downtown Lexington.
Which, by the way, looks very nice. I the first time it went up, I was like, although now, at first I was annoyed that it didn't have specific women, although I think today's podcast has shown how difficult it would have been.
Absolutely.
To actually choose some very specific women to represent in that. And I will say when it's lit up at night, it does look very pretty.
Yeah, it's definitely a welcome addition to the downtown cityscape, if you will. And just walking around, it's like, wow, that is pretty cool. Well, on that note, we will wrap it up for this time. We'll be back next month with another edition of Lexington Stories, Lore, and More. And I want to thank you, Fiona Young-Brown. You are the author of Secret Lexington, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. That's your latest, but you also have other books that that you have authored before.
I do. I have Wicked Lexington, if you're interested in some of the more scandalous side of the city's history. Lexington Then and Now, I think, is still in print. That's old photos, so that you can see how much the city has changed. And if you're not interested in history, but you do like to eat, and doesn't everyone, A Culinary History of Kentucky.
Oh, we got to bring you back in here when we talk about food.
I can always talk about food.
Well, we'll be thinking about that, and we'll see you the next time that we meet on Lexington Stories, Lore, and More.